But we have another year to go before that happy moment of farewell, said Snape softly. So whether you are intending to attempt N.E.W.T. or not, I advise all of you to concentrate your efforts upon maintaining the high pass level I have come to expect from my O.W.L. students. Today we will be mixing a potion that often comes up at ordinary wizarding level. The Draught of Peace. A potion to calm anxiety and soothe agitation. Be warned. If you are too heavy-handed with the ingredients, you will put the drinker into a heavy and sometimes irreversible sleep. So you will need to pay close attention to what you are doing. On Harry's left, Hermione sat up a little straighter, her expression one of the utmost attentiveness. The ingredients and method, Snape flicked his wand, are on the blackboard. They appeared there. You will find everything you need, he flicked his wand again, in the store cupboard. The door of the said cupboard sprang open. You have an hour and a half. Start. Just as Harry, Ron, and Hermione had predicted, Snape could hardly have set them a more difficult, fiddly potion. The ingredients had to be added to the cauldron in precisely the right order and quantities. The mixture had to be stirred exactly the right number of times, firstly in clockwise, then in counterclockwise directions. The heat of the flames on which it was simmering had to be lowered to exactly the right level for a specific number of minutes before the final ingredient was added. A light silver vapor should now be rising from your potion, called Snape, with 10 minutes left to go. Harry, who was sweating profusely, looked desperately around the dungeon. His own cauldron was issuing copious amounts of dark grey steam. Ron's was spitting green sparks. Seamus was feverishly prodding the flames at the base of his cauldron with the tip of his wand as they had gone out. The surface of Hermione's potion, however, was a shimmering mist of silver vapor, and as Snape swept by, he looked down his hooked nose at it without comment, which meant that he could find nothing to criticize. At Harry's cauldron, however, Snape stopped, looking down at Harry with a horrible smirk on his face. Potter, what is this supposed to be? The Slytherins at the front of the class all looked up eagerly. They loved hearing Snape taunt Harry. The Draught of Peace, said Harry tensely. Tell me, Potter, said Snape softly, can you read? Draco Malfoy laughed. Yes, I can, said Harry, his fingers clenched tightly around his wand. Read the third line of the instructions for me, Potter. Harry squinted at the blackboard. It was not easy to make out the instructions through the haze of multicolored steam now filling the dungeon. Add powdered moonstone, stir 3 times counterclockwise, allow to simmer for 7 minutes, then add 2 drops of syrup of hellebore. His heart sank. He had not added syrup of hellebore, but had proceeded straight to the 4th line of the instructions after allowing his potion to simmer for 7 minutes. Did you do everything on the 3rd line, Potter?
No, said Harry very quietly.
I beg your pardon?
No, said Harry more loudly. I forgot the hellebore.
I know you did, Potter, which means that this mess is utterly worthless. Evanesco!
The contents of Harry's potion vanished. He was left standing foolishly beside an empty cauldron.
Those of you who have managed to read the instructions, fill 1 flagon with a sample of your potion, label it clearly with your name, and bring it up to my desk for testing, said Snape. Homework? 12 inches of parchment on the properties of moonstone and its uses in potion making, to be handed in on Thursday.
While everyone around him filled their flagons, Harry cleared away his things, seething. His potion had been no worse than Ron's, which was now giving off a foul odor of bad eggs, or Neville's, which had achieved the consistency of just mixed cement, and which Neville was now having to gouge out of his cauldron. Yet it was he, Harry, who would be receiving 0 marks for the day's work. He stuffed his wand back into his bag, and slumped down onto his seat, watching everyone else march up to Snape's desk with filled and corked flagons. When at long last the bell rang, Harry was first out of the dungeon and had already started his lunch by the time Ron and Hermione joined him in the great hall. The ceiling had turned an even murkier grey during the morning. Rain was lashing the high windows.
"That was really unfair," said Hermione consolingly, sitting down next to Harry and helping herself to shepherd's pie. "Your potion wasn't nearly as bad as Goyle's. When he put it into his flagon, the whole thing shattered and set his robes on fire."
"Yeah, well," said Harry, glowering at his plate, "since when has Snape ever been fair to me?" Neither of the others answered. All three of them knew that Snape and Harry's mutual enmity had been absolute from the moment Harry had set foot in Hogwarts.
"I did think he might be a bit better this year," said Hermione in a disappointed voice. "I mean, you know."
She looked carefully around. There were half a dozen empty seats on either side of them, and nobody was passing the table.
"Now he's in the order and everything."
"Poisonous toadstools don't change their spots," said Ron sagely. "Anyway, I've always thought Dumbledore was cracked, trusting Snape. Where's the evidence he ever really stopped working for you-know-who?"
"I think Dumbledore's probably got plenty of evidence, even if he doesn't share it with you, Ron," snapped Hermione.
"Oh, shut up, the pair of you," said Harry heavily, as Ron opened his mouth to argue back. Hermione and Ron both froze, looking angry and offended.
"Can't you give it a rest?" he said. "You're always having a go at each other. It's driving me mad."
And abandoning his shepherd's pie, he swung his school bag over his shoulder and left them sitting there. He walked up the marble staircase two steps at a time, past the many students hurrying toward lunch. The anger that had just flared so unexpectedly still blazed inside him, and the vision of Ron and Hermione's shocked faces afforded him a sense of deep satisfaction.
"Serve them right," he thought. "Why can't they give it a rest? Bickering all the time, it's enough to drive anyone up the wall."
He passed the large picture of Sir Cadogan the Knight on a landing. Sir Cadogan drew his sword and brandished it fiercely at Harry, who ignored him.
"Come back, you scurvy dog! Stand fast and fight!"
yelled Sir Cadogan in a muffled voice from behind his visor. But Harry merely walked on, and when Sir Cadogan attempted to follow him by running into a neighbouring picture, he was rebuffed by its inhabitant, a large and angry-looking wolfhound. Harry spent the rest of the lunch hour sitting alone underneath the trapdoor at the top of North Tower, and consequently he was the first to ascend the silver ladder that led to Sybil Trelawney's classroom when the bell rang. Divination was Harry's least favourite class after potions, which was due mainly to Professor Trelawney's habit of predicting his premature death every few lessons. A thin woman, heavily draped in shawls and glittering with strings of beads, she always reminded Harry of some kind of insect, with her glasses hugely magnifying her eyes. She was busy putting copies of battered, leather-bound books on each of the spindly little tables with which her room was littered when Harry entered the room, but so dim was the light cast by the lamps covered by scarves and the low-burning, sickly-scented fire that she appeared not to notice him as he took a seat in the shadows. The rest of the class arrived over the next 5 minutes. Ron emerged from the trapdoor, looked around carefully, spotted Harry, and made directly for him, or as directly as he could while having to wend his way between tables, chairs, and overstuffed poofs.
"Hermione and me have stopped arguing," he said, sitting down beside Harry.
"Good," grunted Harry.
"But Hermione says she thinks it would be nice if you stopped taking out your temper on us," said Ron.
"I'm not.
I'm just passing on the message," said Ron, talking over him. "But I reckon she's right. It's not our fault how Seamus and Snape treat you."
"I never said it."
"Good day,"
said Professor Trelawney in her usual misty, dreamy voice, and Harry broke off, feeling both annoyed and slightly ashamed of himself again.
"And welcome back to divination. I have, of course, been following your fortunes most carefully over the holidays, and am most delighted to see that you have all returned to Hogwarts safely, as of course I knew you would. You will find on the tables before you copies of The Dream Oracle by Inigo Imago. Dream interpretation is a most important means of divining the future, and one that may very probably be tested in your OWL. Not, of course, that I believe examination passes or failures are of the remotest importance when it comes to the sacred art of divination. If you have the seeing eye, certificates and grades matter very little. However, the headmaster likes you to sit the examination, so...
Her voice trailed away delicately, leaving them all in no doubt that Professor Trelawney considered her subject above such sordid matters as examinations.
Turn, please, to the introduction and read what Imago has to say on the matter of dream interpretation. Then divide into pairs. Use the dream oracle to interpret each other's most recent dreams. Carry on.
The one good thing to be said for this lesson was that it was not a double period. By the time they had all finished reading the introduction of the book, they had barely 10 minutes left for dream interpretation. At the table next to Harry and Ron, Dean had paired up with Neville, who immediately embarked on a long-winded explanation of a nightmare involving a giant pair of scissors wearing his grandmother's best hat. Harry and Ron merely looked at each other glumly.
"I never remember my dreams," said Ron. "You say one."
"You must remember one of them," said Harry impatiently.
He was not going to share his dreams with anyone. He knew perfectly well what his regular nightmare about a graveyard meant. He did not need Ron or Professor Trelawney or the stupid dream oracle to tell him that.
"Well, I had one that I was playing Quidditch the other night," said Ron, screwing up his face in an effort to remember. "What do you reckon that means?"
"Probably that you're going to be eaten by a giant marshmallow or something," said Harry, turning the pages of the dream oracle without interest. It was very dull work looking up bits of dreams in the oracle, and Harry was not cheered up when Professor Trelawney set them the task of keeping a dream diary for a month as homework. When the bell went, he and Ron led the way back down the ladder, Ron grumbling loudly.
"Do you realize how much homework we've got already? Binns set us a foot and a half long essay on giant wars, Snape wants a foot on the use of moonstones, and now we've got a month's dream diary from Trelawney. Fred and George weren't wrong about OWL year, were they? That Umbridge woman had better not give us any..."
When they entered the Defense Against the Dark Arts classroom, they found Professor Umbridge already seated at the teacher's desk, wearing the fluffy pink cardigan of the night before and the black velvet bow on top of her head. Harry was again reminded forcibly of a large fly perched unwisely on top of an even larger toad. The class was quiet as it entered the room. Professor Umbridge was as yet an unknown quantity, and nobody knew yet how strict a disciplinarian she was likely to be.
"Well, good afternoon," she said when finally the whole class had sat down.
A few people mumbled good afternoon in reply.
"Tut, tut," said Professor Umbridge. "That won't do now, will it? I should like you, please, to reply, 'Good afternoon, Professor Umbridge.' One more time, please. Good afternoon, class."
"Good afternoon, Professor Umbridge," they chanted back at her.
"There now," said Professor Umbridge sweetly. "That wasn't too difficult, was it? One's away and Quill's out, please."
Many of the class exchanged gloomy looks. The order, "one's away," had never yet been followed by a lesson they had found interesting. Harry shoved his wand back inside his bag and pulled out quill, ink, and parchment. Professor Umbridge opened her handbag, extracted her own wand, which was an unusually short one, and tapped the blackboard sharply with it. Words appeared on the board at once. "Defense Against the Dark Arts, a return to basic principles."
"Well now, your teaching in this subject has been rather disrupted and fragmented, hasn't it?"
stated Professor Umbridge, turning to face the class with her hands clasped neatly in front of her.
"The constant changing of teachers, many of whom do not seem to have followed any ministry-approved curriculum, has unfortunately resulted in your being far below the standard we would expect to see in your OWL year. You will be pleased to know, however, that these problems are now to be rectified. We will be following a carefully structured, theory-centered, ministry-approved course of defensive magic this year. Copy down the following, please."
She wrapped the blackboard again. The first message vanished and was replaced by "Course Aims, 1. understanding the principles underlying defensive magic. 2. Learning to recognize situations in which defensive magic can legally be used. 3. Placing the use of defensive magic in a context for practical use. For a couple of minutes, the room was full of the sound of scratching quills on parchment. When everyone had copied down Professor Umbridge's 3 course aims, she said,
"Has everybody got a copy of Defensive Magical Theory by Wilbert Slinkard?"
There was a dull murmur of assent throughout the class.
"I think we'll try that again," said Professor Umbridge. "When I ask you a question, I should like you to reply, 'Yes, Professor Umbridge,' or 'No, Professor Umbridge.' So, has everyone got a copy of Defensive Magical Theory by Wilbert Slinkard?"
"Yes, Professor Umbridge," rang through the room.
"Good," said Professor Umbridge. "I should like you to turn to page 5 and read chapter 1, Basics for Beginners. There will be no need to talk."
Professor Umbridge left the blackboard and settled herself in the chair behind the teacher's desk, observing them all closely with those pouchy toad's eyes. Harry turned to page 5 of his copy of Defensive Magical Theory and started to read. It was desperately dull, quite as bad as listening to Professor Binns. He felt his concentration sliding away from him. He had soon read the same line 6 times without taking in more than the first few words. Several silent minutes passed. Next to him, Ron was absent-mindedly turning his quill over and over in his fingers, staring at the same spot on the page. Harry looked right and received a surprise to shake him out of his torpor. Hermione had not even opened her copy of Defensive Magical Theory. She was staring fixedly at Professor Umbridge with her hand in the air. Harry could not remember Hermione ever neglecting to read when instructed to, or indeed resisting the temptation to open any book that came under her nose. He looked at her questioningly, but she merely shook her head slightly to indicate that she was not about to answer questions, and continued to stare at Professor Umbridge, who was looking just as resolutely in another direction. After several more minutes had passed, however, Harry was not the only one watching Hermione. The chapter they had been instructed to read was so tedious that more and more people were choosing to watch Hermione's mute attempt to catch Professor Umbridge's eye than to struggle on with Basics for Beginners. When more than half the class were staring at Hermione rather than at their books, Professor Umbridge seemed to decide that she could ignore the situation no longer.
"Did you want to ask something about the chapter, dear?"
she asked Hermione, as though she had only just noticed her.
"Not about the chapter, no," said Hermione. "Well, we're reading just now,"
said Professor Umbridge, showing her small pointed teeth.
"If you have other queries, we can deal with them at the end of class." "I've got a query about your course, Ames," said Hermione.
Professor Umbridge raised her eyebrows.
"And your name is?"
"Hermione Granger,"
said Hermione.
"Well, Miss Granger, I think the course aims are perfectly clear if you read them through carefully,"
said Professor Umbridge in a voice of determined sweetness.
"Well, I don't," said Hermione bluntly. "There's nothing written up there about using defensive spells."
There was a short silence in which many members of the class turned their heads to frown at the 3 course aims still written on the blackboard.
"Using defensive spells?"
Professor Umbridge repeated with a little laugh.
"Why, I can't imagine any situation arising in my classroom that would require you to use a defensive spell, Miss Granger. You surely aren't expecting to be attacked during class."
"We're not going to use magic?"
Ron ejaculated loudly.
"Students raise their hands when they wish to speak in my class, Mr.
Weasley," said Ron, thrusting his hand into the air. Professor Umbridge, smiling still more widely, turned her back on him. Harry and Hermione immediately raised their hands too. Professor Umbridge's pouchy eyes lingered on Harry for a moment before she addressed Hermione.
"Yes, Miss Granger, you wanted to ask something else?"
"Yes," said Hermione. "Surely the whole point of defense against the dark arts is to practice defensive spells?"
"Are you a ministry-trained educational expert, Miss Granger?"
asked Professor Umbridge in her falsely sweet voice.
"No, but..."
"Well, then, I'm afraid you're not qualified to decide what the whole point of any class is. Wizards much older and cleverer than you have devised our new program of study, You will be learning about defensive spells in a secure, risk-free way.
What use is that? Said Harry loudly. If we're going to be attacked, it won't be in a...
Hand, Mr. Potter,
sang Professor Umbridge. Harry thrust his fist in the air. Professor Umbridge promptly turned away from him again, but now several other people had their hands up too.
And your name is...
Professor Umbridge said to Dean. Dean Thomas.
Well, Mr. Thomas?
Well, it's like Harry said, isn't it?
Said Dean.
If we're going to be attacked, it won't be risk-free.
I repeat,
said Professor Umbridge, smiling in a very irritating fashion at Dean.
Do you expect to be attacked during my classes?
No, but... Professor Umbridge talked over him.
I do not wish to criticize the way things have been run in this school,
she said, an unconvincing smile stretching her wide mouth.
But you have been exposed to some very irresponsible wizards in this class. Very irresponsible indeed. Not to mention...
She gave a nasty little laugh.
Extremely dangerous half-breeds.
If you mean Professor Lupin, piped up Dean Thomas angrily, he was the best we ever...
And, Mr. Thomas, as I was saying, you have been introduced to spells that have been complex, inappropriate to your age group, and potentially lethal. You have been frightened into believing that you are likely to meet dark attacks every other day.
No, we haven't. Hermione said,
we just... Your hand is not up, Miss Granger.
Hermione put up her hand. Professor Umbridge turned away from her.
It is my understanding that my predecessor not only performed illegal curses in front of you, he actually performed them on you.
Well, he turned out to be a maniac, didn't he? Said Dean Thomas hotly. Mind you, we still learnt loads.
Your hand is not up, Mr. Thomas,
trilled Professor Umbridge.
Now, it is the view of the Ministry that a theoretical knowledge will be more than sufficient to get you through your examination, which, after all, is what school is all about. And your name is...
She added, staring at Parvati, whose hand had just shot up.
Parvati Patil! And isn't there a practical bit in our defense against the dark arts, OWL? Aren't we supposed to show that we can actually do the counter curses and things?
As long as you have studied the theory hard enough, there's no reason why you should not be able to perform the spells under carefully controlled examination conditions,
said Professor Umbridge dismissively.
Without ever practicing them before,
said Parvati incredulously.
Are you telling us that the first time we'll get to do the spells will be during our exam?
I repeat, as long as you have studied the theory hard enough.
And what good's theory going to be in the real world? Said Harry loudly, his fist in the air again. Professor Umbridge looked up.
This is school, Mr. Potter, not the real world,
she said softly. So we're not supposed to be prepared for what's waiting out there?
There is nothing waiting out there, Mr. Potter.
Oh, yeah? Said Harry. His temper, which seemed to have been bubbling just beneath the surface all day, was reaching boiling point.
Who do you imagine wants to attack children like yourselves?
Inquired Professor Umbridge in a horribly honeyed voice.
Let's think, said Harry in a mock thoughtful voice. Maybe Lord Voldemort.
Ron gasped. Lavender Brown uttered a little scream. Neville slipped sideways off his stool. Professor Umbridge, however, did not flinch. She was staring at Harry with a grimly satisfied expression on her face.
10 points from Gryffindor, Mr. Potter.
The classroom was silent and still. Everyone was staring at either Umbridge or Harry.
Now, let me make a few things quite plain.
Professor Umbridge stood up and leaned towards them, her stubby-fingered hands splayed on her desk.
You have been told that a certain dark wizard has returned from the dead.
He wasn't dead, said Harry angrily. But yeah, he's returned.
Mr. Potter, you have already lost your house 10 points. Do not make matters worse for yourself,
said Professor Umbridge in one breath without looking at him.
As I was saying, you have been informed that a certain dark wizard is at large again. This is a lie.
It is not a lie, said Harry. I saw him. I fought him.
Detention, Mr. Potter,
said Professor Umbridge triumphantly.
Tomorrow evening, 5 o'clock, my office, I repeat. This is a lie. The Ministry of Magic guarantees that you are not in danger from any dark wizard. If you are still worried, by all means come and see me outside class hours. If someone is alarming you with fibs about reborn dark wizards, I would like to hear about it. I'm here to help. I'm your friend. And now, you will kindly continue your reading. Page 5, Basics for Beginners.
Professor Umbridge sat down behind her desk again. Harry, however, stood up. Everyone was staring at him. Seamus looked half scared, half fascinated.
Harry, no!
Hermione whispered in a warning voice, tugging at his sleeve, but Harry jerked his arm out of her reach. So, according to you, Cedric Diggory dropped dead of his own accord, did he? Harry asked, his voice shaking. There was a collective intake of breath from the class, for none of them, apart from Ron and Hermione, had ever heard Harry talk about what had happened on the night that Cedric had died. They stared avidly from Harry to Professor Umbridge, who had raised her eyes and was staring at him without a trace of fake smile on her face.
"Cedric Diggory's death was a tragic accident," she said coldly.
"It was murder," said Harry. He could feel himself shaking. He had hardly talked to anyone about this, least of all 30 eagerly listening classmates. "Voldemort killed him, and you know it." Professor Umbridge's face was quite blank. For a moment he thought she was going to scream at him. Then she said in her softest, most sweetly girlish voice,
"Come here, Mr. Potter, dear."
He kicked his chair aside, strode around Ron and Hermione, and up to the teacher's desk. He could feel the rest of the class holding its breath. He felt so angry he did not care what happened next. Professor Umbridge pulled a small roll of pink parchment out of her handbag, stretched it out on the desk, dipped her quill into a bottle of ink, and started scribbling, hunched over so that Harry could not see what she was writing. Nobody spoke. After a minute or so, she rolled up the parchment and tapped it with her wand. It sealed itself seamlessly so that he could not open it.
"Take this to Professor McGonagall, dear,"
said Professor Umbridge, holding out the note to him. He took it from her without saying a word, turned on his heel, and left the room, not even looking back at Ron and Hermione, and slamming the classroom door shut behind him. He walked very fast along the corridor, the note to McGonagall clutched tight in his hand, and turning a corner, walked slap into Peeves, the poltergeist, a wide-faced little man floating on his back in midair, juggling several inkwells.
"Why, it's Potty Wee Potter,"
cackled Peeves, allowing two of the inkwells to fall to the ground where they smashed and spattered the walls with ink. Harry jumped backward out of the way with a snarl.
"Get out of it, Peeves!"
"Oh, Crackpot's feeling cranky,"
said Peeves, pursuing Harry along the corridor, leering as he zoomed along above him.
"What is it this time, my fine Potty friend? Hearing voices, seeing visions, speaking in..."
Peeves blew a gigantic raspberry.
"Tongues?"
"I said leave me alone,"
Harry shouted, running down the nearest flight of stairs, but Peeves merely slid down the banister on his back beside him.
"Oh, most think he's barking, the Potty Wee lad, but some are more kindly and think he's just sad, but Peeves he knows better and says that he's mad."
"Shut up!"
A door to his left flew open, and Professor McGonagall emerged from her office looking grim and slightly harassed.
"What on earth are you shouting about, Potter?"
she snapped, as Peeves cackled gleefully and zoomed out of sight.
"Why aren't you in class?"
"I've been sent to see you," said Harry stiffly.
"Sent? What do you mean, sent?"
He held out the note from Professor Umbridge. Professor McGonagall took it from him, frowning, slit it open with a tap of her wand, stretched it out, and began to read. Her eyes zoomed from side to side behind their square spectacles as she read what Umbridge had written, and, with each line, they became narrower.
"Come in here, Potter."
He followed her inside her study. The door closed automatically behind him.
"Well,"
said Professor McGonagall, rounding on him,
"is this true?"
"Is what true?" Harry asked, rather more aggressively than he had intended. "Professor," he added, in an attempt to sound more polite.
"Is it true that you shouted at Professor Umbridge?"
"Yes," said Harry.
"You called her a liar?"
"Yes."
"You told her he who must not be named is back?"
Yes.
Professor McGonagall sat down behind her desk, watching Harry closely. Then she said,
Have a biscuit, Potter.
Have what?
Have a biscuit,
she repeated impatiently, indicating a tartan tin of cookies lying on top of one of the piles of papers on her desk.
And sit down.
There had been a previous occasion when Harry, expecting to be caned by Professor McGonagall, had instead been appointed by her to the Gryffindor Quidditch team. He sank into a chair opposite her and helped himself to a ginger newt, feeling just as confused and wrong-footed as he had done on that occasion. Professor McGonagall set down Professor Umbridge's note and looked very seriously at Harry.
Potter, you need to be careful.
Harry swallowed his mouthful of ginger newt and stared at her. Her tone of voice was not at all what he was used to. It was not brisk, crisp and stern. It was low and anxious, and somehow much more human than usual.
Misbehavior in Dolores Umbridge's class could cost you much more than house points and a detention.
What do you mean?
Potter! Use your common sense,
snapped Professor McGonagall with an abrupt return to her usual manner.
You know where she comes from. You must know to whom she is reporting.
The bell rang for the end of the lesson. Overhead and all around came the elephantine sounds of hundreds of students on the move.
It says here, she's giving you detention every evening this week, starting tomorrow,
Professor McGonagall said, looking down at Umbridge's note again.
Every evening this week?
Harry repeated, horrified.
But Professor, couldn't you?
No, I couldn't,
said Professor McGonagall flatly.
But she is your teacher and has every right to give you detention. You will go to her room at 5 o'clock tomorrow for the first one.
Just remember, tread carefully around Dolores Umbridge.
But I was telling the truth,
said Harry, outraged.
Voldemort's back. You know he is. Professor Dumbledore knows he is.
For heaven's sake, Potter,
said Professor McGonagall, straightening her glasses angrily. She had winced horribly when he had used Voldemort's name.
Do you really think this is about truth or lies? It's about keeping your head down and your temper under control.
She stood up, nostrils wide and mouth very thin, and he stood too.
Have another biscuit,
she said irritably, thrusting the tin at him. No thanks, said Harry coldly.
Don't be ridiculous, she snapped.
He took one. Thanks, he said grudgingly.
Didn't you listen to Dolores Umbridge's speech at the start of term feast, Potter?
Yeah,
said Harry.
Yeah, she said, progress will be prohibited or, well, it meant that the Ministry of Magic is trying to interfere at Hogwarts.
Professor McGonagall eyed him closely for a moment, then sniffed, walked around her desk, and held open the door for him.
Well, I'm glad you listened to Hermione Granger at any rate,
she said, pointing him out of her office.
Chapter 13 Detention with Dolores.
Dinner in the Great Hall that night was not a pleasant experience for Harry. The news about his shouting match with Umbridge seemed to have travelled exceptionally fast, even by Hogwarts standards. He heard whispers all around him as he sat eating between Ron and Hermione. The funny thing was that none of the whisperers seemed to mind him overhearing what they were saying about him. On the contrary, it was as though they were hoping he would get angry and start shouting again so that they could hear his story firsthand.
He says he saw Cedric Diggory murdered. He reckons he duelled with you-know-who. Come off it. Who does he think he's kidding? Police.
What I don't get, said Harry through clenched teeth, laying down his knife and fork, his hands were shaking too much to hold them steady, is why they all believed the story 2 months ago when Dumbledore told them.
The thing is, Harry, I'm not sure they did,
said Hermione grimly.
Oh, let's get out of here.
She slammed down her own knife and fork. Ron looked sadly at his half-finished apple pie, but followed suit. People stared at them all the way out of the hall.
What do you mean you're not sure they believe Dumbledore? Harry asked Hermione when they reached the first floor landing.
Look, you don't understand what it was like after it happened,
said Hermione quietly.
You arrived back in the middle of the lawn, clutching Cedric's dead body. None of us saw what happened in the maze. We just had Dumbledore's word for it that you-know-who had come back and killed Cedric and fought you.
Which is the truth, said Harry loudly.
I know it is, Harry, so will you please stop biting my head off,
said Hermione wearily.
It's just that before the truth could sink in, everyone went home for the summer where they spent 2 months reading about how you're a nutcase and Dumbledore's going senile.
Rain pounded on the window panes as they strode along the empty corridors back to Gryffindor Tower. Harry felt as though his first day had lasted a week, but he still had a mountain of homework to do before bed. A dull, pounding pain was developing over his right eye. He glanced out of a rain-washed window at the dark grounds as they turned into the fat lady's corridor. There was still no light in Hagrid's cabin.
"Nimbulus Nimbletonia," said Hermione,
before the fat lady could ask. The portrait swung open to reveal the hole behind, and the three of them scrambled back through it. The common room was almost empty. Nearly everyone was still down at dinner. Crookshanks uncoiled himself from an armchair and trotted to meet them, purring loudly. And when Harry, Ron, and Hermione took their three favorite chairs at the fireside, he leapt lightly into Hermione's lap and curled up there like a furry ginger cushion. Harry gazed into the flames, feeling drained and exhausted.
"How can Dumbledore have let this happen?"
Hermione cried suddenly, making Harry and Ron jump. Crookshanks leapt off her, looking affronted. She pounded the arms of her chair in fury so that bits of stuffing leaked out of the holes.
"How can he let that terrible woman teach us? And in our OWL year too?"
"Well, we've never had great defense against the dark arts teachers, have we?" said Harry. "You know what it's like. Hagrid told us. Nobody wants the job. They say it's jinxed."
"Yes, but to employ someone who's actually refusing to let us do magic? What's Dumbledore playing at?"
"And she's trying to get people to spy for her," said Ron darkly.
"Remember when she said she wanted us to come and tell her if we hear anyone saying you know who's back?" "Of course she's here to spy on us all, that's obvious. Why else would Fudge have wanted her to come?"
snapped Hermione.
"Don't start arguing again,"
said Harry wearily, as Ron opened his mouth to retaliate.
"Can't we just... let's just do that homework. Get it out of the way."
They collected their school bags from a corner and returned to the chairs by the fire. People were coming back from dinner now. Harry kept his face averted from the portrait hole, but could still sense the stares he was attracting.
"Shall we do Snape stuff first?"
said Ron, dipping his quill into his ink.
"The properties of Moonstone and its uses in potion making,"
he muttered, writing the words across the top of his parchment as he spoke them.
"There,"
he underlined the title, then looked up expectantly at Hermione.
"So, what are the properties of Moonstone and its uses in potion making?"
But Hermione was not listening. She was squinting over into the far corner of the room, where Fred, George, and Lee Jordan were now sitting at the center of a knot of innocent-looking first years, all of whom were chewing something that seemed to have come out of a large paper bag that Fred was holding.
"No, I'm sorry, they've gone too far,"
she said, standing up and looking positively furious. "Come on, Ron."
"I... what?" said Ron, plainly playing for time.
"No, come on, Hermione, we can't tell them off for giving out sweets. You know perfectly well that those are bits of nosebleed nougat, or puking pastilles, or..."
"Fainting fancies," Harry suggested quietly. One by one, as though hit over the head with invisible mallets, the first years were slumping unconscious in their seats. Some slid right onto the floor, others merely hung over the arms of their chairs, their tongues lolling out. Most of the people watching were laughing. Hermione, however, squared her shoulders and marched directly over to where Fred and George now stood with clipboards, closely observing the unconscious first years. Ron rose halfway out of his chair, hovered uncertainly for a moment or two, then muttered to Harry,
"She's got it under control,"
before sinking as low in his chair as his lanky frame permitted.
"That's enough,"
Hermione said forcefully to Fred and George, both of whom looked up in mild surprise.
"Yeah, you're right," said George, nodding. "This dosage looks strong enough, doesn't it?"
"I told you this morning, you can't test your rubbish on students."
"We're paying them," said Fred indignantly.
"I don't care. It could be dangerous."
"Rubbish," said Fred.
"Calm down, Hermione. They're fine,"
said Lee reassuringly, as he walked from first year to first year, inserting purple sweets into their open mouths.
"Yeah, look, they're coming round now," said George.
A few of the first years were indeed stirring. Several looked so shocked to find themselves lying on the floor or dangling off their chairs but Harry was sure Fred and George had not warned them what the sweets were going to do.
"Feel all right?"
said George kindly to a small dark-haired girl lying at his feet.
I think so,
she said shakily.
Excellent,
said Fred happily. But the next second Hermione had snatched both his clipboard and the paper bag of fainting fancies from his hands.
It is not excellent. Course it is. They're alive, aren't they?
Said Fred angrily.
You can't do this. What if you made one of them really ill? We're not going to make them ill. We've already tested them all on ourselves. This is just to see if everyone reacts the same. If you don't stop doing it, I'm going to...
Put us in detention, said Fred, in an I'd-like-to-see-you-try-it voice. Make us write lines, said George, smirking.
Onlookers all over the room were laughing. Hermione drew herself up to her full height. Her eyes were narrowed, and her bushy hair seemed to crackle with electricity.
No,
she said, her voice quivering with anger.
But I will write to your mother.
You wouldn't, said George, horrified, taking a step back from her.
Oh, yes, I would,
said Hermione grimly.
I can't stop you eating the stupid things yourselves, but you're not giving them to first years.
Fred and George looked thunderstruck. It was clear that as far as they were concerned, Hermione's threat was way below the belt. With a last threatening look at them, she thrust Fred's clipboard and the bag of fancies back into his arms and stalked back to her chair by the fire. Ron was now so low in his seat that his nose was roughly level with his knees.
Thank you for your support, Ron,
Hermione said acidly.
You handled it fine by yourself, Ron mumbled.
Hermione stared down at her blank piece of parchment for a few seconds. Then she said edgily,
Oh, it's no good. I can't concentrate now. I'm going to bed.
She wrenched her bag open. Harry thought she was about to put her books away, but instead she pulled out two misshapen woolly objects, placed them carefully on a table by the fireplace, covered them with a few screwed-up bits of parchment and a broken quill, and stood back to admire the effect.
What in the name of Merlin are you doing?
Said Ron, watching her as though fearful for her sanity.
They're hats for house elves,
she said briskly, now stuffing her books back into her bag.
I did them over the summer. I'm a really slow knitter without magic, but now I'm back at school, I should be able to make lots more. You're leaving out hats for the house elves?
Said Ron slowly.
And you're covering them up with rubbish first?
Yes,
said Hermione defiantly, swinging her bag onto her back.
That's not on, said Ron angrily. You're trying to trick them into picking up the hats. You're setting them free when they might not want to be free.
Of course they want to be free,
said Hermione at once, though her face was turning pink.
Don't you dare touch those hats, Ron.
She turned on her heel and left. Ron waited until she had disappeared through the door to the girls' dormitories, then cleared the rubbish off the woolly hats.
They should at least see what they're picking up, he said firmly.
Anyway, he rolled up the parchment on which he had written the title of Snape's essay.
There's no point trying to finish this now. I can't do it without Hermione. I haven't got a clue what you're supposed to do with moonstones, have you?
Harry shook his head, noticing as he did so that the ache in his right temple was getting worse. He thought of the long essay on giant wars, and the pain stabbed at him sharply. Knowing perfectly well that he would regret not finishing his homework tonight when the morning came, he piled his books back into his bag.
I'm going to bed too.
He passed Seamus on the way to the door leading to the dormitories, but did not look at him. Harry had a fleeting impression that Seamus had opened his mouth to speak, but sped up and reached the soothing peace of the stone spiral staircase without having to endure any more provocation. The following day dawned just as leaden and rainy as the previous one. Hagrid was still absent from the staff table at breakfast.
But on the plus side, no Snape today,
said Ron bracingly. Hermione yawned widely and poured herself some coffee. She looked mildly pleased about something, and when Ron asked her what she had to be so happy about, she simply said,
The hats have gone. Seems the house elves do want freedom after all.
I wouldn't bet on it,
Ron told her cuttingly.
They might not count as clothes. They didn't look anything like hats to me, more like woolly bladders.
Hermione did not speak to him all morning. Double Charms was succeeded by Double Transfiguration. Professor Flitwick and Professor McGonagall both spent the first 15 minutes of their lessons lecturing the class on the importance of OWLs.
"What you must remember,"
said little Professor Flitwick squeakily, perched as ever on a pile of books so that he could see over the top of his desk,
"is that these examinations may influence your futures for many years to come. If you have not already given serious thought to your careers, now is the time to do so. And in the meantime, I'm afraid we shall be working harder than ever to ensure that you all do yourselves justice."
They then spent more than an hour reviewing summoning charms, which, according to Professor Flitwick, were bound to come up in their OWL, and he rounded off the lesson by assigning them their largest amount of charms homework ever. It was the same, if not worse, in Transfiguration.
"You cannot pass an OWL," said Professor McGonagall grimly, "without serious application, practice, and study. I see no reason why everybody in this class should not achieve an OWL in Transfiguration as long as they put in the work."
Neville made a sad little disbelieving noise.
"Yes, you too, Longbottom," said Professor McGonagall. "There's nothing wrong with your work, except lack of confidence. So, today we are starting Vanishing Spells. These are easier than conjuring spells, which you would not usually attempt until NEWT level, but they're still among the most difficult magic you will be tested on in your OWL.
She was quite right. Harry found the vanishing spells horribly difficult. By the end of double period, neither he nor Ron had managed to vanish the snails on which they were practicing, though Ron said hopefully that he thought his looked a bit paler. Hermione, on the other hand, successfully vanished her snail on the third attempt, earning her a 10-point bonus for Gryffindor from Professor McGonagall. She was the only person not given homework. Everybody else was told to practice the spell overnight, ready for a fresh attempt on their snails the following afternoon. Now panicking slightly about the amount of homework they had to do, Harry and Ron spent their lunch hour in the library looking up the uses of moonstones in potion-making. Still angry about Ron's slur on her woolly hats, Hermione did not join them. By the time they reached Care of Magical Creatures in the afternoon, Harry's head was aching again. The day had become cool and breezy, and as they walked down the sloping lawn toward Hagrid's cabin on the edge of the Forbidden Forest, they felt the occasional drop of rain on their faces. Professor Grubbly Plank stood waiting for the class some 10 yards from Hagrid's front door, a long trestle table in front of her laden with many twigs. As Harry and Ron reached her, a loud shout of laughter sounded behind them. Turning, they saw Draco Malfoy striding toward them, surrounded by his usual gang of Slytherin cronies. He had clearly just said something highly amusing, because Crabbe, Goyle, Pansy Parkinson, and the rest continued to snigger heartily as they gathered around the trestle table. Judging by the fact that all of them kept looking over at Harry, he was able to guess the subject of the joke without too much difficulty.
"Everyone here!"
barked Professor Grubbly Plank, once all the Slytherins and Gryffindors had arrived.
"Let's crack on, then. Who can tell me what these things are called?"
She indicated the heap of twigs in front of her. Hermione's hands shot into the air. Behind her back, Malfoy did a buck-tooth imitation of her, jumping up and down in eagerness to answer a question. Pansy Parkinson gave a shriek of laughter that turned almost at once into a scream as the twigs on the table leapt into the air and revealed themselves to be what looked like tiny pixie-ish creatures made of wood, each with knobbly brown arms and legs, two twig-like fingers at the end of each hand, and a funny flat bark-like face in which a pair of beetle-brown eyes glittered.
"Ooh,"
said Parvati in lavender, thoroughly irritating Harry. Anyone would have thought that Hagrid never showed them impressive creatures. Admittedly, the flobberworms had been a bit dull, but the salamanders and hippogriffs had been interesting enough, and the blast-ended scroots, perhaps too much so.
"Kindly keep your voices down, girls,"
said Professor Grubbly Plank sharply, scattering a handful of what looked like brown rice among the stick creatures, who immediately fell upon the food.
"So, anyone know the names of these creatures, Miss Granger?"
"Bowchuckles,"
said Hermione.
Their tree guardians usually live in wand trees.
5 points to Gryffindor, said Professor Grubblyplank. Yes, these are Beltracles, and as Miss Granger rightly says, they generally live in trees whose wood is of wand quality. Anybody know what they eat?
Woodlice,
said Hermione promptly, which explained why what Harry had taken for grains of brown rice were moving.
But fairy eggs, if they can get them.
Good girl. Take another 5 points. So, whenever you need leaves or wood from a tree in which a Beltracle lodges, it is wise to have a gift of woodlice ready to distract or placate it. They may not look dangerous, but if angered, they will gouge out human eyes with their fingers, which, as you can see, are very sharp and not at all desirable near the eyeballs. So, if you'd like to gather closer, take a few woodlice and a Beltracle. I have enough here for one between three. You can study them more closely. I want a sketch from each of you with all body parts labelled by the end of the lesson.
The class surged forward around the trestle table. Harry deliberately circled around the back so that he ended up right next to Professor Grubblyplank. "Where's Hagrid?" he asked her, while everyone else was choosing Beltracles.
"Never you mind,"
said Professor Grubblyplank repressively, which had been her attitude last time Hagrid had failed to turn up for a class too. Smirking all over his pointed face, Draco Malfoy leaned across Harry and seized the largest Beltracle.
"Maybe," said Malfoy in an undertone, so that only Harry could hear him. The stupid great oaf's got himself badly injured.
Maybe you will if you don't shut up, said Harry out of the side of his mouth.
Maybe he's been messing with stuff that's too big for him, if you get my drift.
Malfoy walked away, smirking over his shoulder at Harry, who suddenly felt sick. Did Malfoy know something? His father was a Death Eater, after all. What if he had information about Hagrid's fate that had not yet reached the Order's ears? He hurried back around the table to Ron and Hermione, who were squatting on the grass some distance away, and attempting to persuade a Beltracle to remain still long enough to draw it. Harry pulled out parchment and quill, crouched down beside the others, and related in a whisper what Malfoy had just said.
"Dumbledore would know if something had happened to Hagrid," said Hermione at once. "It's just playing into Malfoy's hands to look worried. It tells him we don't know exactly what's going on. We've got to ignore him, Harry. Here, hold the Beltracle for a moment, just so I can draw its face."
"Yes," came Malfoy's clear drawl from the group nearest them. "Father was talking to the Minister just a couple of days ago, you know, and it sounds as though the Ministry is really determined to crack down on substandard teaching in this place. So even if that overgrown moron does show up again, he'll probably be sent packing straight away."
"Ouch!"
Harry had gripped the Beltracle so hard that it had almost snapped. It had just taken a great retaliatory swipe at his hand with its sharp fingers, leaving 2 long, deep cuts there. Harry dropped it. Crabbe and Goyle, who had already been guffawing at the idea of Hagrid being sacked, laughed still harder as the Beltracle set off at full tilt toward the forest, a little moving stick man soon swallowed up by the tree roots. When the bell echoed distantly over the grounds, Harry rolled up his blood-stained Beltracle picture and marched off to Herbology, with his hand wrapped in a handkerchief of Hermione's and Malfoy's derisive laughter still ringing in his ears.
"If he calls Hagrid a moron one more time," said Harry through gritted teeth.
"Harry, don't go picking a row with Malfoy. Don't forget, he's a prefect now. He could make life difficult for you."
"Wow, I wonder what it'd be like to have a difficult life," said Harry sarcastically.
Ron laughed, but Hermione frowned. Together they traipsed across the vegetable patch. The sky still appeared unable to make up its mind whether it wanted to rain or not.
"I just wish Hagrid would hurry up and get back, that's all," said Harry in a low voice as they reached the greenhouses.
"And don't say that Grubblyplank woman's a better teacher," he added threateningly.
"I wasn't going to,"
said Hermione calmly,
"because she'll never be as good as Hagrid.
said Harry firmly, fully aware that he had just experienced an exemplary care of magical creatures lesson and was thoroughly annoyed about it. The door of the nearest greenhouse opened and some fourth years spilled out of it, including Ginny.
"Hi,"
she said brightly as she passed. A few seconds later, Luna Lovegood emerged, trailing behind the rest of the class, a smudge of earth on her nose and her hair tied in a knot on the top of her head. When she saw Harry, her prominent eyes seemed to bulge excitedly, and she made a beeline straight for him. Many of his classmates turned curiously to watch. Luna took a great breath and then said, without so much as a preliminary hello,
"I believe he who must not be named is back, and I believe you fought him and escaped from him."
Right, said Harry awkwardly. Luna was wearing what looked like a pair of orange radishes for earrings, a fact that Parvati and Lavender seemed to have noticed as they were both giggling and pointing at her earlobes.
"You can laugh," Luna said, her voice rising, apparently under the impression that Parvati and Lavender were laughing at what she had said rather than what she was wearing. "But people used to believe there were no such things as the blibbering humdinger or the crumple-horned snorkack."
"Well, they were right, weren't they?"
said Hermione impatiently.
"There weren't any such things as the blibbering humdinger or the crumple-horned snorkack."
Luna gave her a withering look and flounced away, radishes swinging madly. Parvati and Lavender were not the only ones hooting with laughter now. "Do you mind not offending the only people who believe me?" Harry asked Hermione as they made their way into class.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, Harry, you can do better than her," said Hermione. "Ginny's told me all about her. Apparently she'll only believe in things as long as there's no proof at all. Well, I wouldn't expect anything else from someone whose father runs the Quibbler."
Harry thought of the sinister winged horses he had seen on the night he had arrived, and how Luna had said she could see them too. His spirits sank slightly. Had she been lying? But before he could devote much more thought to the matter, Ernie Macmillan had stepped up to him.
"I want you to know, Potter," he said in a loud, carrying voice, "that it's not only weirdos who support you. I personally believe you 100%. My family have always stood firm behind Dumbledore, and so do I."
Thanks very much, Ernie," said Harry, taken aback but pleased. Ernie might be pompous on occasions like these, but Harry was in a mood to deeply appreciate a vote of confidence from somebody who was not wearing radishes in their ears. Ernie's words had certainly wiped the smile from Lavender Brown's face, and, as he turned to talk to Ron and Hermione, Harry caught Seamus's expression, which looked both confused and defiant. To nobody's surprise, Professor Sprout started their lesson by lecturing them about the importance of OWLs. Harry wished all the teachers would stop doing this. He was starting to get an anxious, twisted feeling in his stomach every time he remembered how much homework he had to do, a feeling that worsened dramatically when Professor Sprout gave them yet another essay at the end of class. Tired and smelling strongly of dragon dung, Professor Sprout's preferred brand of fertilizer, the Gryffindors trooped back up to the castle an hour and a half later, none of them talking very much. It had been another long day. As Harry was starving, and he had his first detention with Umbridge at 5 o'clock, he headed straight for dinner without dropping off his bag in Gryffindor Tower so that he could bolt something down before facing whatever she had in store for him. He had barely reached the entrance of the Great Hall, however, when a loud and angry voice said, "Oi, Potter!" "What now?" he muttered wearily, turning to face Angelina Johnson, who looked as though she was in a towering temper.
"I'll tell you what now," she said, marching straight up to him and poking him hard in the chest with her finger. "How come you've landed yourself in detention for 5 o'clock on Friday?"
"What?" said Harry.
"Why, oh, yeah, keeper tryouts." "Now he remembers," snarled Angelina. "Didn't I tell you I wanted to do a tryout with the whole team and find someone who fitted in with everyone? Didn't I tell you I'd book the Quidditch pitch specially? And now you've decided you're not going to be there."
"I didn't decide not to be there," said Harry, stung by the injustice of these words.
"I got detention from that Umbridge woman, just because I told her the truth about you-know-who."
"Well, you can just go straight to her and ask her to let you off on Friday," said Angelina fiercely. "And I don't care how you do it.
Tell her you know who's a figment of your imagination, if you like. Just make sure you're there.
She turned on her heel and stormed away.
You know what?
Harry said to Ron and Hermione as they entered the Great Hall. I think we'd better check with Puddlemere United whether Oliver Wood's been killed during a training session, because she seems to be channeling his spirit.
What do you reckon are the odds of Umbridge letting you off on Friday?
Said Ron skeptically as they sat down at the Gryffindor.